go. A press so hard they could not stand.
Let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way down.
Down
in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live on the Land of Israel Network from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom!
Oh, shalom, Yishai. It's great to see you.
It's great to have you back in the show, in our life. You were out in England, merry old England.
Merry old, chilly old England.
Yes.
Although
yes.
I have to admit, I didn't leave the hotel for 5 days, except when I saw it was snowing, I stepped out the door for 2 minutes just to enjoy it.
Did you stay in the hotel where the conference was at?
Indeed, I did.
Because I didn't. I stayed in the one across the pond.
Well, this was a luxury trip for me. They invited me. They put me up. They paid for my plane ticket. All I had to do was teach. It's
That's
like
right.
The glory days.
No, I had a similar package, but I was in the hotel across the pond.
Oh.
So I had to be one of those walkers, but it was really great. I actually enjoyed that. It was beautiful. In Birmingham, you did a great job. I heard a lot of reports that there was a lot of fun out there.
Thank God. Well received.
Very good. Very good. Limud.
Mission accomplished.
Good for them for having the good folks over. Yourself, Eve Harrow. Ari King was there.
That's
Ashley
right.
Perry.
You know, you should know. I don't know if Eve told you. She told me when I asked her how her second session went. She said, well, if I should ever have to stand in front of a firing squad, now at least I know I can do it.
Uh-huh. It's funny because I was able to – I actually like – didn't feel the firing squad at all. I kind of got out of that pretzel and was just – I just didn't feel it all. There was no like – even though there was a lot of people, and my favorite thing that happened last year at Limud for me was a guy takes – there's like this drink session at the evenings, and the guy comes up to me and goes, can I buy you a drink? I'm like, okay. He goes, I hated everything you said. But you were brilliant.
That's so British.
Yeah, so brilliant. I was like, thank you, I guess. Anyway, it was really good times, and it's good to see so many Jews getting together.
It's amazing.
For the sake of learning and growing
simply
together.
Simply amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's a lot of volunteerism. Listen, we're in a transition zone here in the world, that's for sure, okay? The Trump presidency, whatever you think of President Trump per se as an individual, there's no question that there's what is it called? The Muttel Wolf used to say you kick a dent in the world or something like that, or how do they say it? You know, the clock move, or you made a change.
Major mark.
Yeah, what's the actual word?
I don't know what you're after here.
You know, you're trying to make a change in the world a little bit.
Sure,
there's a word. There's a word, and some enterprising listener will send it to me correctly. In any case, the world is having some turns right now.
Things are happening.
Things are happening. And I want to start the show today by saying hi to the people of Iran. Right, so the people of Iran right now are in the streets, and they are fighting a completely tenacious and no-holds-barred regime.
More power to them.
Right.
More power to them.
To the people.
To the people. Power
right.
to the people. Yeah.
Because the regime has no...
there's no shame or mercy.
Right. Ein Matzurim. There's no they have nothing, no holds barred.
If a person has any doubts, all they need to do is look back at the history of the Iran-Iraq War, where they would literally use, you know, their own citizens dressed in white, ready to go to heaven to demine fields by
children,
walking out
children,
upon them.
Children, especially children. That was Ahmadinejad was in charge of that unit. He would wrap kids in mattresses so that the next kids that see like a blowing up friend of theirs don't get too upset when they yeah. would. That's what Ahmadinejad was in charge of.
He found his calling.
Bad dude. And right now they're out there rejecting this regime. In part, by the way, I also saw pictures of a lot of people protesting for the regime. So it's not exactly clear what's happening out there, but there's a lot of people protesting against the regime, and they're risking their life. No question about it. They're risking their life. They're risking their future. No doubt about it. We saw what happened, by the way, in Turkey. When Erdogan wants to crack down on people, 40,000 people get arrested. Like,
that's
no
right.
problem.
And lots of them just disappear.
Right. So these guys, they really don't have any moral qualms about doing anything. And for us, of course, geostrategically here in Israel, the hopeful toppling of the Iranian regime would mean a tremendous change because they're the number one enemy right now. No question about that. So I wanted to kind of start the show by saying, hey, you know, we're with you out here. And yes, we're going to pray to the God of Israel to help you win, you know, throw off the regime of evil.
Well, listen, we're starting the Book of Redemption, right, the Book of Shemot, of Exodus, and there couldn't be a better time for people to be struggling for its freedom.
Right. Okay, so we're starting a new book. We said Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazak, or not Chazak, Venit Chazek.
That's an argument between the guy who reads the Torah and the rest of my congregation in my shul.
Why? Well, he says...
He says Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazak,
right,
which is apparently grammatically correct.
Right, which means, in any case, whatever it means is from strength to strength.
Strong, strengthen yourselves.
Right, like okay, but that's just a weird way to end a book of the Bible.
I love it. It's one of my favorite moments of the entire sort of pageant of being in shul. We all shout out, yeah, we did it, move on.
We love those things. We love the bang at the moon, those weird pageantry things that we do. Those are awesome moments.
You told them about the bang at the moon?
And you stand up in shul and everybody says chazak. Chazak, and it gives you kind of a thing, but it's also like there's an end chapter. We just finished the end of Bereshit. It just flew past us. All those great questions of Abraham, you know, asking, will he have a future? Will there be a continuation of his seed? Isaac struggling with the Philistines. Jacob with the dream of the ladder, struggling with his brother. The whole wives thing and having children. The whole Joseph issue. Joseph going down to Egypt. The rapprochement between him and the brothers, and that all suddenly ends in last week's Torah portion, Vayechi, and the memory of the forefathers gets locked away in this kind of. I don't mean locked away. I mean to say locked in, and we're going to actually see the forefathers. They do make appearances in this week's Torah portion,
absolutely,
in terms of their memory of the promises. Well, that God made.
We're looking at the transformation from a family to a people. And in many ways, a family you can always trace genetically, meaning in theory or at least by marriage, right? What's a people? You know, the word for people in Hebrew is am, which is identical, except in its pronunciation, with the word im, which means with. And that's really the Torah's definition of people. It's the people you can imagine being with. And what holds us together more than our sense that we share the stories of our forefathers.
I was just in the mall across the street here, the Hadar Mall. By the way, there's the word for mall in Hebrew is kinyon, from the word kniya. But it's also like a canyon of shopping. Yes.
Canyon of shopping where you just get stuff.
Right. And I want to tell you something. A lot of religious people in this mall.
Sure.
And... there was just that feeling that you described just now. I was like, Im, this is my Am.
Yes.
I'm Im, my Am.
Yes. And if you think about it, that's what allows us to go. I mean, thank God the Jewish people are returning from our dispersion, but that's what's allowed us for most of history to go to such far-flung places. People who may not look like us, may not share our language, but there's something in which we are together. And really, more than anything else, it's the stories of our ancestors.
So... The thing about the ancestors is that they were kind of loud and proud. You knew about them. It was Abraham, you're a prince of God amongst us. Isaac, you know, you have become wealthier than us. Leave. Everybody knows who you are. You know, Jacob in the land, and the nations are afraid of him in the land as he's traveling. Chitat Elohim. Okay. Now, this noble people is going to be sublimated into this host culture, which is going to start to reject them. And we suddenly are going to meet a new type of feeling in the Bible, which is the underground.
Mm-hmm.
Moses is born underground. You know, he's born as the whole beginning of the story is the birth of, you know, this hidden birth that's being hidden away and kept away. And then he's sent off on this, you know, watery, potentially, you know, death finality for Moses. He's picked up by this house of Pharaoh, and then he's saved again because he's going to be fed by the Jewish nursemaid, which happens to be his mother. But it doesn't start out with that prideful, famous nobility.
So much so that all the names are missing, right? The beginning of Moses, the great redeemer, the one who brought the Torah down to us from God, begins with a nameless man of the tribe of Levi who takes a nameless woman from the tribe of Levi, who has a child who remains nameless. He openly only gets his name from the daughter of power herself.
Right.
Right. The underground image is very strong here, because what happens in the end is that the Jewish people, we're not Jewish people at this point, Am Yisrael, right? Am Yisrael bursts forth through, I would say underground, but it's also in the womb. Right. There's a process of a gestation of a people that's happening here. which is far greater, actually, than just the simple family lies of the forefathers.
And Moses is, not only is he in this kind of womb and he comes out, but then we if you watch the movies about Moses, the cartoons and all that, they do a fair amount of him growing up, both the Ten Commandments and Prince of Egypt, do a fair amount of him growing up in the house of Pharaoh and becoming a prince of Egypt.
Right.
The Torah does not.
Nope. It just takes it for granted. He grew up, his first concern was what's happening with his people out in the fields.
Right. Like, he knows somehow that he is a Hebrew. He's related to them, and he goes out there. So where's the discrepancy between what we've been kind of told and the reality of how the Bible tells it? Or another way of saying it is, like, why did the Torah skip so much?
Well, I mean, I could see it in a number of ways. The first thing that came up for me when you pointed it out is that part of it is just simply the vastly different cultural lens of the Torah and Western society that produced those movies. Western society operates on the assumption that everybody is intrinsically like everybody else. So therefore, what they want to do is humanize Moshe and make him just like the Egyptians. And in that, there is actually quite a powerful, and the Prince of Egypt has a very powerful emotional and moral struggle embedded in this sense that Moshe is truly the brother of Pharaoh. But the Torah, especially in the book of Shemot and Exodus, is trying to explain to the world that the Jewish people are not like everybody else. That Am Yisrael is actually a vehicle for a divine finger in history, which sets us apart from the Egyptian nations. Therefore, I think the Torah has no incentive whatsoever, although it does give us a little bit of a hint. Gives us a little bit of a hint when Moshe, not to skip too much forward in the story, right, he grows up, he goes out, he sees his brothers, and I'm sure we'll come back to that scene. Ultimately, things go poorly, and he has to run away. And he finds himself by a well where the daughters of the priest of Midian identify him as who?
An Egyptian.
An Egyptian. So right. We see this, that he walked like an Egyptian. He dressed like an Egyptian. Perhaps he even spoke like an Egyptian. So it's a good hint that the Hollywood perspective is not off base. It's just not the concern of the Torah.
Okay, Rabbi Mike, don't jump the gun yet. We're not there. We're almost there. One thing that we skipped over is also that the Egyptians kind of changed their mind about the Jews.
Something happened.
It could be that Joseph had created this society, which is economically unequal.
He did introduce slavery into Egypt.
Slavery into Egypt. And on the other hand, his family, the family of Israel, was supported by the state somehow. Could be that there was an unpleasant political situation.
Historically speaking, that there was actually a change between what were known as the Hyksos, the shepherd kings that had invaded Egypt. And what we're seeing in the background here is this sort of revolution of the Egyptian people throwing off what they perceived to be foreign invaders.
Right.
And the Jews, the Israelites, the family of Israel, getting swept up in that.
Right. And the Hyksos were like Canaanites, and they were like
They were large nomadic shepherd peoples. I mean, in that subtext that we see several times at the end of Genesis where Yosef says, well, don't tell them you're shepherds. They don't like shepherds. Don't tell them you're shepherds. As much as we have a sort of theological perspective that the Egyptians worship sheep, it might be that the historical perspective is it's bad news. We've got a bad name around here.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But either way, there arises a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph.
And there's also the introduction of this infanticide.
Yes.
This killing of the Jewish male babies.
Not just the Jewish male babies. And at least on one day, all male babies. Don't forget, when Paro says that, you know, that every male should be thrown into the river, it's very clear that means every male in that one day, because the astronomers and the magicians had told him on this day the Redeemer of Israel would be born and that he will be punished in water. And so that was the announcement. Everybody into the river.
It also says that the Jewish people were the land was filled up with them. V'temale ha'aretz otam.
Have you ever tried to do the math of going from 70 to 600,000 men? You can do it if you end up having six children at once, which, as of course, the sages teach us.
Right.
But it's an astoundingly rapid population growth, which, by the way, the Jewish people have seen at other times of our
history.
That's right.
In fact, one of the most astounding population growths, historically speaking, is the DP camps right after the Holocaust. Now, if I was a Holocaust survivor, I'd think to myself, forget it.
No way.
It's over. This world is dark. I don't want any part of it.
Well, having children is the ultimate assertion of optimism.
Right.
Or complete madness.
My wife's father was born in a DP camp.
Yeah.
In one of these shotgun type weddings, you know?
It's
like not shotgun, like let's do this, let's get married. Let's get right. married and have babies.
Shotgun wedding means that somebody else is saying you're gonna marry my daughter.
Yeah, no, I meant to say in that case, a rapid fire wedding.
Yes, okay. Perhaps was what you were searching for.
Yes.
I won't tell Malga.
Okay, a quick wedding. And that's what happened there. By the way, in the Torah, there's only one other place that it says V'timaleh Haaretz. There's Timaleh Haaretz Otam, which we learn here, and V'timaleh Haaretz Hamas. Okay. And basically, it's like it's either us or Hamas in this land.
That's crazy how you can read the Torah in that light, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Any case, so we hear of the birth of Moses again. He's underground, and yet he's kind of the Medrash says the room like fills up with light.
Mm-hmm.
I said this. I was a
kid's gotta glow.
I gave some talk somewhere, and I'm like, and we're gonna deal with the birth of Moses, the first Mashiach. I said, and people just looked at me like, you know, like that was like an uncomfortable thing to say, but like this is a Messiah figure.
True, although I mean you remember that in Hebrew Mashiach means anointed. So he's really the first redeemer, which is what you meant.
Goel.
Right, the first Goel in Hebrew. Right. But I know what you mean, and you are correct in that sense. And it's very important to remember that for Am Yisrael, the Mashiach is not a magical, mystical, divine being. Mashiach is, at least if we adhere to the Rambam, which I personally do, a political leader who is going to help us achieve our goals in this world.
Right. Now, he is going to get a quick lesson also about if you're going to be a redeemer.
You better be ready for the people that you're redeeming.
Not so easy. If you folks want, you know, you get an inside view into Moses' first political experience with the Jewish people, you know, first
baptism by fire.
That's right. First day he rescues a Jew from being bludgeoned to death or whipped to death by Egyptian taxmaster. Next day, two Jews are fighting, and he's like, "Brothers, well, why do you fight amongst yourselves? We need to be united."
And they say, "Who are you?
Who are you? Who? What are you going to do? Kill us like you did the dude yesterday?"
Oops.
Oh man,
the secret's out.
It's been. There's no more underground here. It's been talked about. Interestingly enough, we saw at that previous verse. He looked to see that there are no people looking.
Right.
And he slew the Egyptian taskmaster, but there were people looking. Some people say that it may be very much the person that he saved, the dude that he saved from
might
the Egyptian.
Might have indeed ratted on him.
Ratted him out. But another explanation is, Vayafen kovacho vayarken ish, a person should look, and he saw that there was no man, there's no person like him to be responsible for the situation.
That's right.
So we have to take responsibility. Sometimes you have to look around and say, look, I'm the responsible person. Sure, I don't want to do it because I want to be lazy, but I'm the responsible person, so I have to do it.
That is indeed the hallmark of what makes Moshe great. We see it not only in this moment when he could have easily, he's a prince of Egypt. He could have just simply turned away. Jews are getting beaten every day in the field. In the same way, when he's on the run, hiding from the Egyptians, when he goes and finds himself at some safe moment by the well, And the shepherds begin to harass these young women that he sees come. What does he do? He should keep to himself. He's a stranger. He doesn't know the lay of the land. This is the last thing he does. He says, you can't oppress these women. That's right. He immediately intervenes.
That's right. And these are women. These are weaker elements in that society. He doesn't know the norms of society. He doesn't even know if they're right or wrong.
Correct.
He doesn't know if they're the owners of that well or not.
Right.
But he stands, and he's in a totally weak position. I would have aligned myself with the strong people, right?
Or at least kept your mouth shut.
Right. But he immediately stands up, and that's when God says, you're the one. You are the one. You have both a personal, a particular, and a universal approach.
Yes.
He's got both of those.
And like you said, you're not a bystander.
Right. You're not. That's it. Vayifen kovacho, he looked around. Vayar kieni, so there's no other
nobody
person.
Else.
I got to do it. And yet though, right, if this was Hollywood, it would have been like, okay, you know, this is the training music is on, you know, he's
like
born,
Rocky,
right. He's born in a questionable situation and, you know, and he rises up and he gets tough and
doom.
Right. And he's like,
I'm feeling excited.
Right. And he's killing an Egyptian and he's running away and he's dealing with the tricky Jews. And he runs away, and he stands up for the women, and he gets placed in this awesome family. I think here Prince of Egypt does do a good job at giving you a sense of who Jethro Yitro is, this kind of jolly, you know, figure who
one-time pagan.
Right. One-time super pagan,
super
right?
Pagan, right?
Super number one pagan, but like pagan warrior. And then finally, God's like, this is my man. And here's the mission. Should you choose to accept it, right? Here it is. And God is going to show up to Moshe Rabbeinu in this burning bush. In my opinion, by the way, the predecessor to the menorah, right? He shows him the menorah. He shows him this everlasting menorah, which we're going to learn also about in the book of Zechariah. It's this everlasting, non-stopping menorah. The first one, the light of the world, is this sneboer, this burning bush. And it's like, dude, I need you to go down and let my people go, right? And it's like, no. No thanks. Moses answers.
Ask somebody else.
Right.
With the sheep and I don't just got do married. It.
There's better people. There's better talkers out there. There's better people out there. And there is, the Medrash says that 7 days of negotiations.
Yes.
To the point that God is going to be frustrated with Moshe Rabbeinu. And here's like, you know, is this the Platonic philosopher that has to be kind of forced to lead the people? Is this kind of like okay, you know, like G-D is talking to you, you know, and he's telling you, go do this thing. What is this Moses character that he reneges and gives a hard time to the Lord of hosts when it's time to do the bidding?
To me, what I'm picturing is he's a vessel. He is a vessel for redemption first.
Because he does say Hineni, right? He says
Hineni. He says, I am here.
I'm here. I'm ready.
Right? And not only that, but he notices the bush. Right? One of the things I've been taught by my teachers is that the turning point is when Moshe notices the bush. You can see it in the verse there. It says that, and when God saw that he turned aside to see the bush, that's when God called out to him. So one can imagine that bush has actually been there since the 6 days of creation. And no one has seen it. In the same way, like when Moshe looked here and there and saw that there's nobody else who can take care of this situation, he's not going to ignore things that fit outside of his normal assumptions. So many of us walk through the world, and anything which doesn't fit the way we want to see the world, we simply don't see.
He's got eyes.
He has eyes, but he has a deep honesty. And because of that, he looks at himself and he says, actually, I know exactly who I am, and I'm not the guy that you want, God. You need the superhero. You need, you know, the redeemer. That's not me, God. And what God essentially responds to him and says, no, what I need is you, because you know who you are. Because what's going to come through you, Moshe, is so big. First, the redemption, and then the Torah, is that I can't have you getting in the way. You need to be able to be my vessel in the world, and because of that, you need to be full of exactly what you are and not 1 ounce
but,
more.
But there's a steer. There's a conflict in what you're saying.
What's that?
Which is, if you're such a vessel, then be the vessel. But he's a pushback vessel.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
he's not totally vessel-y. He's kind of like,
no, he's not an empty vessel.
Right.
He's just not over full of himself.
Well, let's see it actually in the verses. Vayomer Moshe el ha'elokim. Moshe says to the God, Mi anochi? Who am I? Ki elech el paro, that I should go to Pharaoh, v'chi otzi abni Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, that I should take out the children of Israel from Egypt. So God says to him, Vayomer ki eheyeimach, I'm going to be with you, and I'm going to give you signs. And that sign is that you're going to serve me on this mountain. And he keeps trying. Then Moses will say to him, well, how will they know? Who exactly should I say sent me? And he says, tell him, I will be that which I will be. Tell them I will be sent you. So that's another one of the names of God, right?
Yes.
And then finally, there's one more level, which is he's like, you know, how will I stand in front of Pharaoh? So he gives him these signs.
Mm-hmm.
The chuck down the
staff will become a snake.
The staff becomes a python snake. You know?
Water becomes blood.
Well, the second one is, first it's the snake, then it's the hand in the coat.
The water, the blood is the third?
The blood is the third, right? He sticks the hand in the coat, he pulls it out, and it is white, and it is mitzvah, it has...
Leprous.
Leprous, right? And then the last one is he takes the blood, and yep. he spills it, he takes the blood, he takes water, spills it on the ground, and it becomes blood. These are the signs. Just very quickly, three signs. They can mean, one thing is you can make a snake into a stick, right? a stick into a snake. Or here's what it really means. It says, maybe, it says, he says, God says to him, you see that snake? Now grab it by the tail. Are you supposed to grab a snake by the tail?
No, you grab it behind the head.
By the head. Grab it by the tail. You will control Egypt. You will control Egypt. Egypt is the snake. It is the this water going, you know, alligator
creature.
You can control it. He says, but maybe Moses will say to God, but the Jewish people, they're already all messed up. They're in the 49th level
of impurity.
He says, look, put your hand in. You see your hand is impure. Now stick it back in. Boom. I can make it. I can heal him. I can make it pure. But will they really follow me? And then he says to him, you see this water? It could turn into blood. What could that mean? I struggled with this for a long time. What could the blood turning into water mean? So here's my thought, okay?
Okay.
The Nile covered up the infanticide, the murder of these babies. And it's got this clear water. It's like, you see this? The blood will be seen. There will be revenge. The world will know the truth.
Well,
what they did.
That is much of what the story is about. God says repeatedly as we move forward, we'll speak about it in the coming weeks, that what I'm doing now is in order that they know. Right? And it's a very important thing. I think about it often as we return to this point in the story in particular, is that, you know, like my kids ask me sometimes, well, like, why are we reading the same story again? Why are we reading the same story? And the answer is because knowing is not a point of information. We don't read this story because you need to know that this happened. Read the story because it needs to be the way in which we know the world. Mm. We need to know the world through the lens that God intervenes in the world, because he didn't create creation and walk away and say, good luck, folks. Right? And we live in a time, I think, where it's easier to understand that than perhaps it's been for the last 3,000 years. Because look where we're sitting. You know, if we had gone back to your image of your wife's grandfather who got married at the rapid fire wedding in the DP camps, if you had asked him whether God intervened in the world, it might have been a tough sell. It might have been a tough sell. But here, 70 years later, it's a tough sell in my mind to say that it doesn't.
Right.
And so this is a way in which we can read this story, and it isn't just something that we know. It's the way in which we know the world. And that's what's happening here. That's a type of transformation. Oh, you think this is water. You think you know what you're looking at? I'm going to show you what it really is. And then it's not just the water changes back and forth, but now you know something more important, which is that things are not as they appear. That's the real lesson that I hear there.
Yes, Moses is... I still don't quite understand why he gives God such a hard time. I still don't understand that. But we do know there is a clue. The clue is, this is the most humble man who ever walked the earth. The most humble man.
And it's important to define that word properly, because with all due respect to our Christian brothers and sisters, there's a cultural gap between the definition that the Torah offers of humility and that which Western society does. Humility is not loneliness. In Hebrew, loneliness is shval ruach, right? To be lowly is its own value, perhaps. To be humble is to be exactly what you are, not 1 ounce more, but also not 1 ounce less.
Right.
And it's really in this moment that God teaches it to Moshe. Because Moshe is perfectly prepared to be less than what he is, or not to be more than what he is. But God's telling him, okay, you don't be more than what you are, but you also aren't allowed to be less. And this is why he's calling him to his greatness.
Also, we learned that Moses is—he says about himself that he's heavy of speech.
Right.
He's heavy of speech, and God says, "No problem. I've got the answer. I know somebody who's the berry, the bear. I know somebody who's a talker, and that is Aaron, your brother. And he's going to be glad to see you. He's going to be glad, and then we're going to see later that he's going to be actually glad to see him in the desert. And when he tells him everything, this is also." A mark of humility, which is like he's not jealous of his brother. Quite the opposite.
This is such an important moment. This moment, by the way, it's the only second use of the word samach in the entire Torah. The first one is in regards to Lavan. So there's a question there whether one can really really rely on that as real simcha, as real joy. But this is a moment in which all of the family conflicts, which have dominated the Sefer of Bereishit, of Genesis. I mean, the whole book, as a couple of my students pointed out to me last week, is like a what not to do for parents, you know, sadly. I mean, in the brother conflict, we just ended with this epic 3-4 parsha story of brotherly conflict. And here, the first union between these brothers comes through the fact that God says, oh, you think your brother will be jealous if I make you the prophet? You don't understand your brother. He's going to see you. He's going to be overjoyed. And this is such a beautiful fixing for so many of the challenges of the book of Genesis.
Hey, man, we should really feel that in our lives. Jealousy is one of the most destructive of feelings, and it's so wrong. One of the things that really cures jealousy is really understanding that God directs every single one of us in our pathway.
Yeah, it's a feeling of abundance. That what one other person has does not mean I have to have less.
Right. And just my personal thing is, I like to add to people. I don't believe that Moses was a stutterer. I don't think so. I think that he was heavy. I'm heavy of speech.
He was quite heavy.
He talks heavy. He talks straight to you. He doesn't
says it like it is.
Says it like it is, and it's off-putting. As opposed to the talker, who's more. And we know about Aaron that he's a diplomat.
Yes.
He's a peacemaker.
Yes.
He's a peacemaker. Even to his detriment at some points. But he's a
we'll
peacemaker.
We'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that when we get to it. But that's what he is, essentially, is a peacemaker and a diplomat, and he's a talker.
You know, there's a real challenge in this. I mean, many people will say that Moshe is ish emet and Aaron ish shalom. Moshe is the person of truth.
Right.
And Aaron is a person of peace.
Right.
And from this, we see a widespread discussion in the sort of broader sense of Torah of whether peace and truth can coexist. It's really not so simple. On one hand, I feel like that where we are today as a people, there are certain truths that need to be said to the world.
Right.
There are certain truths that need to be said about our history. There are certain truths that need to be said about the nature of what justice is in the world. At the same time, I don't think that that's what's going to produce peace. I think that's something we need to do as a people in order that we can come to the place where we can say, fine, you want to see it that way? That's fine. I don't really care. Let's put things back together. But we're not at the stage of peace today. I think it's a mistake to pursue peace right now. I think right now what needs to be pursued is justice, even though I know that comes at quite a price.
If you think about it might be really the difference between conservatism and liberalism on some level. Conservatism is a more like truth doctrine. Here's the past. Here's what we should be doing. This is, you know, we shouldn't be kind of over, you know, if liberalism is marked sometimes with too much liberalism, too much liberty to things, too much.
Almost an over-idealistic.
Right, a kind of naivete and a granting of, you know, giving. It's really a giving type of ideology.
And almost wishful thinking in times.
Right, as opposed to kind of a more, the truth is, I earned this, capitalism, let's call conservatism, let's mark, you know, equate that with capitalism. It's like, I earned this money, this is my fence, good fences make good neighbors.
Right,
it's
but like, the extreme version of the conservative is just a complete inflexibility and unwillingness to see other.
Right.
So, meaning each one has its, what we call kilkul, it has its sort of debased form, and what I'm thinking about is the question of what are we called to right now? Ultimately, the world is meant to head toward peace. Ultimately, the world is meant
that,
to
is that
shalom.
Right? Is that right?
Yes.
Or
the world is meant to head toward shalom.
Isn't
yes,
it ultimately, it's more towards emet, which is
no, good. no, for sure not. This is not the world of truth.
I'm saying, but in the end of time,
that's Amidati. I mean, that's the next world. But this world is a world of peace, but I don't believe that we can get there without justice coming to the fore first.
Right. Yeah, there's an interplay between those two things. And even in the Psalms, it says, you know, there's a verse there about these things coexisting, about the coexistence of Emet and Shalom. I actually made rings like that for my wife with that verse. Chesed ve'emet nifkashu tzedek v'shalom nashaku.
Right.
So tzedek is like emet, right? It's like justice and shalom. They like kissed, they embraced. Yeah, there's definitely a tension like that. By the way, interestingly enough, I read in the Chalban last week that's the difference also between Joseph and Jacob in terms of burial. Jacob was like, I cannot be buried here. I need to be buried in the land of Israel. I need to be the truth, the model of truth. The truth is we belong in Eretz Israel. But Joseph, who's more with the people.
He's a connector.
Right, a connector is like going to be down with the people, even though it's not in a level of truth, but it's in a level of shalom. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be embracing you.
And yet it's ultimately he that keeps that connection alive that brings the people back.
Right, but without having the
absolutism of right, saying this is really where we belong.
Right, and we got to go to Maariv HaMakpelah, and that's where we absolutely.
Yep.
They interplay.
Well, for sure, and not only that, but
even look at our bodies. I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but just I was just looking at you, and then I thought to myself, our skeletons are these hard things, and they stay even behind us after we're dead. But the flesh around it, which is this constantly moving, supple thing. Soft and flexible,
and
not
therefore
rigid.
Expressive, right?
Right. Without those bones, right? Expressive. That's a very deep. That's very beautiful. What you just said, really, that the face is through its.
Have you ever read any Levinas?
Yes, I did. I had to read it in class. Yeah, for
it's very important. It's a very important thought in terms of the role that the face plays in seeing the uh, the Tel Melukim, the divine image in other.
Right, but you still need the bones, right?
Well, without the bones, you'd just be a jellyfish. Yes, you meaning there needs to be some structure on which this sort of supple expressiveness can actually rest. Without it, it's simply mush.
Wow. Okay, folks, we just got a little deep there. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me back from England. Missed you there for 2 weeks, and we're in the book of Shemot. We're in the book of Exodus. Movement of people. All right, and we're in chapter 3 of the book of Exodus, and God is still giving him the full vision. Still giving Moses the full vision of what it's going to look like, and you know it's going to be awesome. God says, you know, and tell the king of Egypt that you want to leave, and then when you do leave, I'm going to give you're going to request of the Egyptians clothing and gold. They're going to give it to you, and you're going to leave, right? And that way, you're going to also empty out Egypt. So there's this whole big vision. He's giving him the full enchilada of where it's all going to go, right?
In a manner of speaking,
right?
Yes, but you know, I want to come back to something that we kind of skipped over. That question that Moshe says, "Who shall I tell them sent me?"
Right.
You know, it's fascinating that name, right? I will be that which I will be.
That's like the ultimate of like, don't try to figure me out. I will be which I will be, right?
It's a name which can only be said in the first person.
Right.
Right? So we see that Moshe never tells it to them.
Right.
And yet, if we had
although we do sing it, we do have songs like on Yom Kippur, I think in the Yom Kippur Shmon Esrei, and it's like, the Chazan does that.
It remains a name of God, and if we had more time together, I could show you a couple of key places in the Hebrew Bible and the Tanakh where it reappears, but it's always spoken by God, of course, because it's in the first person. And it begs this question of what is the process that Moshe himself has to undergo in order to become the Redeemer who not only brings the people out of Egypt, but brings the Torah down from God to humanity. It's this ability to say God in the first person, to find that place within himself where he is truly expressive of not his own will or not his understanding of God's will, but God's will itself is a phenomenal accomplishment.
And God reveals about himself a lot also.
He must.
Right. That face-to-face. Right. Like you have to be. Right. This accomplishment of seeing God face-to-face. But he also reveals to us in this text, Moses says to him, you know, send somebody else. I'm not a man of words. This is one of my favorite verses. He says, Misam tel Adam. Who made the mouth of man? Like, to me, this would be like a self, like, what else needs to be said? That's why I struggle sometimes with how long this argument is. Because, like, God could be like, listen, I created you. What do you want? Misam tel Adam. Who made a mouth to the man? Mi asum ilem or chiresh. Who makes a dumb or deaf or blind person? It's me. Like, I do all that.
Right. I will take care of it. But one thing God can't do in this, as it were, he can't decide to go.
Right.
What God wants from Moshe here, and that's why I believe that what's underlying this is really the power of redemption. Right? You know the old joke, how many psychiatrists or psychologists does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Right? The real changes in life happen when we desire that they happen. Because what God does not want here is a mechanistic universe.
Right.
Right? You might think that, oh gosh, the world kind of went off the rails somehow. Again, by the way, read Genesis. Oh, I have to fix it. God becomes the fix-it man. It's not what God wants. God wants a new consciousness to be born in the world through the desire that we do his will of our own will. And that's why it begins with Moshe. That's why God bothers to negotiate.
You know what? I think I buy it. I think I can buy that. I think what you're saying is very good. You're saying you got to want it.
Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything. Like he says, like, I made the mute. I made the deaf. I could bring the people out of Egypt on my own. Thank you very much.
Right.
But you don't get what's going on here, Moshe. I want you to do it. And I don't just want you to do it. I want you to want to do it. And ultimately, Moshe does come to this.
And I want you to tell the king of Egypt also, B'ni B'chori Israel.
Yes.
I want you to tell him, my firstborn son is Israel.
So this, to me, is one of the most important verses in the Torah. And it really, I think, illuminates what I'm speaking about. Because, you know, I celebrate two birthdays every year. I don't know, not just the Hebrew and English, the slave date in the Jewish calendar.
Aliyah?
No, not that one either, although I could add
Tshuva, the Tshuva date?
No, the day that my first daughter was born, my first child. Uh-huh. Why? Because that's the day on which I became a father. And that's something I can't do for myself. That's something, in a sense, that my wife, of course, and my daughter did for me. Right? I could call myself a father. I can walk around and I could be Father Mike or whatever it is. And until I have children, it's just something inside my head. But once you have a child, you have fundamentally changed. And this is what God is saying. There is some aspect of my divinity, so to speak, which cannot be expressed in the world without Am Yisrael. B'ni b'chori Yisrael. I am now ready to be that in the world because you are ready to be that.
In Melech Beloam.
Yes.
There's no nation without. There's no king without a nation. And that's interesting what you're saying, because also the name of Israel is going to be interchanged here. There's going to be one point where they speak to Pharaoh and they're like, the God of Israel. So he's like, I never heard of that.
Who's this guy you're speaking about? Right?
Sorry, never heard of that. But then they'll be like the God of the Hebrews. They'll switch back to the old way of how Egypt understood the Semitic clan.
Yes.
That is the Hebrew people. As opposed to the theological and tribal, it's like, okay.
And I'm familial, personal.
Right.
Yeah, so there's by the way, you can do incredible analysis of the names and the terminology used here in reference to God and Am Yisrael, which, you know, like everyone has their perspective on it. The biblical critical does its own thing. But I think that what you're picking up on is the very many-layered nature of what it is to be Am Yisrael in the world.
That's interesting you say that. I definitely think that there are three main names to Israel. I think that the one name is Hebrew. To me, that's the name of the genetic or ethnic.
Sure, the ethnicity.
The ethnicity is Hebrew. The cultural, linguistic, and just all informational, all our behavior patterns, all that, that's called Yehudi. That's, we behave Jewishly. You know, it's Jewish. It's Yiddishkeit.
Right.
Right? And Yisrael is our tribal, political.
And ideal, visionary.
And ideal, right. And also super. That's like our super.
The visionary.
Right. That's like but it only happens usually when we're in the land of Israel or when we're united. It's like a united, moving people. That's when we're Israel. When we're separated, we're Jews.
It was not a small thing that the Zionists chose to call this country Israel and not Judea.
Yeah, that's right. It's huge. Exactly. It's not Judea. It's Israel.
Yep.
God, and here I sometimes, with great humility, disagree with some of the Parshanim. To me, the name Shin Dalet Yud, right, S-H-A-D-D-A-I, that name represents fertility. And almost at every juncture that you see that word, it is almost always to do with.
So, in what sense are you disagreeing?
Because
with the
they say it's like one of the powerful God of power, the God that said enough should die.
Well, there's two things in the Midrash. That first half is what usually people say, right? Misha amar la'olam
die,
right? Which means enough. But the other half of that Midrash that they're quoting refers to it as shadi, which is to throw something out. Like if you were holding the end of a spool of string,
right,
and you threw it out there, which is exactly what you're speaking about. It's this sort of procreative, abundant name of God.
I mean, almost always when you see that the SH name, it always has to do with you should be fruitful, multiply type of thing.
Yeah.
And also the name itself kind of hints at you that it's related to breast,
yes,
which relates to mother's milk, as opposed to, and the rest is, the big names are, you know, Elohim, which is the kind of God of judgment, the God of nature, the God of
The powers of the world.
Right, the powers of the world, the godly powers that the world is endowed with. And then there is Yudke Vavke, the Tetragrammaton, which is really the name of...
Which is bigger than the world. Its name holds the world.
Right.
That's where we say God is the place of the world and not the world the place of God.
One of my favorite expressions, I like it in Hebrew, Hu mekomo shel olam ve'en ha'olam mekomo. I love that one.
So Spinoza was half right.
In what sense?
Because he was a pantheist. So he understood one half. He only understood really one name of God. And he didn't understand the fact that you know, what bothered Spinoza was he didn't want to have a world. He believed in God. He was not an atheist. He was a pantheist. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want to have a world in which God was a product of superstition, right? So he believed in the power of reason. But I think Spinoza, like many of the philosophers of the Enlightenment, which he preceded but really gave birth to, were unwilling to live in a world which they couldn't comprehend. I think they didn't appreciate the fact that the human mind is a product of that Shem Elohim, that world God. But there's a much larger context holding us, which the mind cannot grasp.
Let me ask you a question that I've been grappling with recently.
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna. This is out of left field, but is God and Torah two separate things, or is it one thing?
Did you say God in Torah and God?
No, God and God so, and Torah are these two. Are these two separate concepts?
I'm guessing you're familiar with the statement of the Zohar that says that God, Torah, and Israel are one.
Right. Right. Okay.
So I would say
but that's in effect. I mean, say in effect in this world they work as one.
So if one accepts the fact that the Torah we hold in our hands is that which we can grasp and not its wholeness, so then I would say that God and Torah could be one. Right? But you have to remember that what Moshe brought down from Sinai was that which we could receive. And even then, we've been chewing on it for 3,000 and a half years.
Right, but some people say you can't really fathom the Torah.
Of course not, because that's why, particularly in Chassidut, but also in much earlier sources, there's something which is known as the Torah Keduma. The primordial Torah,
right.
That which the Midrash says God looked into the world and looked into the Torah and created the world.
Right.
The Torah becomes the ultimate manifestation of God. It's not the one and the same, because I wouldn't, I don't want to, even open my mouth to say that I know what God is, or that God is even comprehensible or definable in our terminology. But that's why the Torah is infinite.
There's also a phrase that God says, I wish that they would forget me but keep my Torah.
Right, but that's a very pragmatic love for us. That okay, so you forget me, you don't understand, stick with the Torah. It'll bring you back around to me.
I'll tell you why where this came in my head, because I was trying to – I always – when I look at Israel, the state of Israel and the people of Israel and the land of Israel, I think to myself, there's the land, there's the society, the Hebrew-Jewish Israel society, mm-hmm. and then there's the God above. But then I was like, no, there's the land, the people who live by the rules of Torah, another category, and the God above. And I wasn't sure if they were three things or four things.
So I encourage you to think of them as nested. Remember, what are those dolls called? You speak Russian, though. You could probably say it properly.
Matryoshka.
Yeah. Like the nested
dolls. The babushka dolls.
Right?
Yeah.
So I would...
I never heard of it called a nested dolls. You mean like grandma within a grandma.
Right. They're nested.
Yes, yes.
Right? And so I would encourage you to think of it in that sense. But the key is that God is both the innermost and the outermost layer. Right? I mean, if you ask to point to God, ask children to point to God... So they'll usually do one of two things, point up or point at their heart. And both are true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because in the end of the day, ain od milvado, there really is nothing else other than his desire that we be.
Okay. So Rabbi
Back
Mike.
Down to earth.
Yeah. So check this out. We went from the forefathers, then the underground birth of Moses, his miraculous survival, his meeting of his wife, we didn't talk about it so much, but at the well. When he rescues the Midianite women, sisters, and my hero, whole thing. Meanwhile,
Jethro was like, why did you leave him at the well? I've got seven daughters.
That's right, seven daughters. Okay, so, Jethro. We also meet Jethro, by the way, which we're going to meet again.
In a very important circumstance.
Right, and by the way, Jethro's got a great line. He says, Lech l'shalom. He says, go. When Moses is like, listen, I got to take... your daughter and your grandchildren, my sons, we got to go back down to Egypt, and I'm a wanted man there, and my people are enslaved, and I'm going to start a revolution, He's like, go in peace, brother. Yalla. Behatzlacha.
Behatzlacha. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I mean, that's an interesting father-in-law, and the verse is there in the Bible to tell you, this is not a usual man.
Yes, no. And he's also the first person to say Baruch Hashem.
Right.
Later when they get out.
Right. That's right. Lech l'shalom. He says, go in peace, brother.
Right.
Amazing man. But anyway, so far, and we had the great encounter between God and man, great revelation of the burning bush, great vision for the story, and everything is just kind of honky-dory.
We're on a roll.
Right, we're on a roll. Moses is heading down to Egypt to do his bidding. God sends an angel to almost kill his son. What's that about? What's that about there? I mean,
it's first of all, this is one of the sort of wackier and least comprehensible little sort of stories in the Torah.
And yet it's right there, isn't it?
Oh no, it is right there. There's no question. Yeah. But even as you look in the flow of the narrative, it jumps out of you as saying, "What?" Up until now, a fourth grader could have read this and they might have missed
right.
the depth. But we're fine. We're reading
we're
the story.
We're following.
We're following, and then suddenly, it's like the. Bloody bridegroom and the Lord met him and sought to kill him. And
they were at the hotel. They were at the sleeping place.
Right.
And suddenly the Lord met them And he seeks to kill his son.
And it's fascinating to me, even in the structural presentation of the verses of the Torah, that there's no break. It's presented as a continuity with the mission on which he's been sent.
Right.
The way I've always understood this is the central issue here is circumcision. That's without question. This is in fact brought as a proof in the classical text that a woman can be a mohelet, that a woman can actually serve in the role of a formal
ritual circumciser.
Ritual circumciser.
Right.
So to me, it goes to the depth of what a brit is, what a covenant is. That the covenant is not just a contract, and it's not just a simple agreement. It's an absolute dedication one to the other, to the point of death. I mean, you have sons, right? And if anyone listening has never actually been at a circumcision, it is a brutal process.
Yeah, not as brutal as birth, which is even more
true.
Kind of brutal,
that's
yeah.
not a chosen process. Meaning, right. You might choose to get pregnant, but
right.
Once you're pregnant, there's only birth or, God forbid, tragedy, right? So I think, again, consistent with what God wants of Moshe, that God could make Moshe do it. God could bring the Jewish people out of Egypt without Moshe, but he wants Moshe to want it. And so this is the ultimate act. And in whether it happens through Moshe or Tzipora, his wife, is a discussion that's worth having. But the key here is now God says, and now I want you to put this sign in your flesh. You forgot about that, Moshe.
Right.
You can't. We can't go. Remember Avraham?
You can't go down to Egypt to rescue the Jewish people without putting a...
You can't go anywhere anymore. Once I've called to you and you've devoted yourself to me, you must carry the sign in your flesh. It needs to be now.
Right. You got
to
look
tomorrow.
Like a, you got to look like a Jew. You got to be one of them.
No more walking like an Egyptian.
Right. That's a great way of understanding it. Here's another thought, which is, remember when I told you to go rescue my children, and you were like, "No, I'm not the right guy." But you know what? My kids were dying at that time.
Ooh.
He says, "Va'amarta paro." You say to Pharaoh, "Ko amar Hashem bni bechor Yisrael." Say to Pharaoh, "My firstborn child is Israel." Vo'amar alecha, and I told you, Moses. I told you. Shlachet b'ni ve'avduni, send out my children so they should serve me. V'temayen l'shalcho, but you, Moses. Now, it's a double play. It's usually meant Pharaoh. But in this case, no, you, Moses, didn't want to take him out. Hinani och horeget b'incha b'chorcha. I will now show you the pain. You will feel it on your flesh. You've got to know what it means to face a Holocaust. You've been living a happy life, and it was my work that you were in this palace, and then you were with Yitro.
Jethro and his boy.
But I need you down there now, and you don't feel the pain. You don't feel the pain of my people.
This is, I think, a very powerful reading, and it answers the question I had, which is, why is there no break in the text to offset this? And your answer is because it's meant to be read together with what precedes it.
Right. You've got, and that's something that sometimes I remember. There was a girl in Cardozo Law who was half Jewish, whatever that means. I don't remember.
Right. Sure.
I think as I recall correctly, her father was Jewish, her mother was not.
She identified as Jewish.
But she identified as really half Jewish, really. Uh-huh. And she was somewhere in between. And she was supposed to come on our birthright trip that I was organizing. And then something happened in Israel. I don't even remember. And she quit on the birthright trip. And she says to me, canceled.
Yeah.
And I said to her, why did you cancel? She's like, I don't even know if there's going to be in Israel. And when she said that to me, I thought to myself, this girl's not Jewish.
Yeah.
In this case, by the way.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm not trying to cast.
We're just talking about the moment. You were generalizing.
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Rabbi Mike, with your great training here in liberal institutions. Exactly.
Yeah. They
right.
shecked you for that here.
Right. No, but that's what I meant. But it is what I thought myself. You, not you people.
Right.
I thought myself.
You personally.
You're not there, because if you don't understand that Israel's going to make it through this.
There's two pieces there. One of them really, I find the second piece you said, I think, critical and very inspiring. Is that what it is to be a Jew? Is that's what a brit is. You're committed. You're committed. You know, and whether you understand why, or whether it makes sense, or whether you even think it's going to work out well for you, we're in. This is where it's going. The other piece worries me. You know, we're in the midst of a drought here, although please God, we could be in the midst of it breaking. And people, if you're praying, pray harder. If you're not praying yet, start praying. But to me, this drought that's happening is not just a meteorological phenomenon. It's a theological phenomenon. It's a theological phenomenon that's connected deeply to what you said, is that we don't feel the pain enough. Just within our own wonderful and very complex and difficult country here, we don't appreciate the fact that there are so many of our brothers and sisters who live in poverty. There's so many of our brothers and sisters who don't have simply what they need. Forget what they want. And it's just too easy. I mean, in Yiddish, it's an expression, shir zayin yid, right? It's hard to be a Jew.
I heard it on the Jewish Story, Rabbi Mike Foyer's other show here on the Land of Israel Network.
So it's, I repeat it often at this point because I feel one of the great challenges that we face as a people today is that doesn't have to be true. It doesn't have to. You might not have to feel the pain of what it is to be a Jew, either because you could ignore your brothers and sisters, or you could ignore the mission that we face as a people, or you could sit somewhere across the sea in a place that I used to live and pretend that what's happening here in our homeland doesn't affect you, right? And I very much value the reading.
Or just be apathetic to it.
Or just be apathetic, right? And I very much value the reading you're saying here, which is that, Moshe, you had very good reasons for being hesitant. You were being honest and self-effacing. And every minute you wasted, my children were dying.
Right.
You need to feel that pain, Moshe.
You got to feel that pain.
And if you don't feel it, you'll never be the Redeemer.
That's exactly right. I think that's a lesson for all of us. By the way, you mentioned poverty here in Israel. There's other things. For example, today, this bothers me to no end, and not enough, which is there's a tremendous crime wave in the middle of the country, in the farm areas of the Jezreel Valleys and Afula in that region, of like Bedouin and Arab, a kind of crime syndicate that just basically terrorizes and steals cows and steals heads of cattle and all this kind of stuff and farmland. And it's just like they are screaming, are asking for help. The same thing in the Negev. Negev is being taken over. There's tremendous
theft. I've heard from my friends that live down there, you cannot build without paying protection money at this point to the Bedouin.
Right. It's totally out of control. And I whatever involvement I have in the political sphere, I say to them, like, you want to grab an issue? Here's an issue.
Yeah.
Here's an issue that people can, you know, that they really need real help. Any case, speaking of exactly that, speaking of people that have to pay protection, we were getting to this, all right, God, I'm gonna do what you said, and I'm on board, and here I go, and here comes Aaron and Moses, and they do the they stand in front of Pharaoh.
The whole "let my people go" thing.
Let my people go.
Let's not forget the second half of that phrase,
which is what.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, the great injustice of a wonderful movie with Charlton Heston as Moshe, right, is that every American Jew grew up thinking that the message of Passover, of the Exodus, is "let my people go." It's about freedom. But the second half of the phrase is "in order that they serve
me
in the wilderness."
That's right.
The message is that we need to be servants to God and not Paro.
That's right. Let my people go. So that happens a lot of times in American Jewry. They like forget a part of it. For example, I'll never forget the version that they have on Godcast, which is like a version
we've spoken about of Esther.
Of Esther, right? It's like I'm Jewish, I'm strong, and then I'll ask the king to save us and he'll agree.
Or what I find the crazy irony of American Jews who celebrate Hanukkah with great joy, not knowing that it's a holiday which is celebrating religious, what they would call religious fanaticism. I don't mention it because I'd rather they celebrate it. But.
In any case, the way this Torah portion ends is that, in fact, Pharaoh says, "Ain't nothing doing.
I'm doubling down.
I'm doubling down hardcore." And by the way, that's a great lesson for everybody. Everybody should know. Yeah. When you mess with the bad dudes, they double
down.
They
don't back down.
They don't back down. Just so you know that.
They got in power in the first place.
Right. That's right. When you face the UN and you're like, okay, we're going to be tough against you, like, don't think that they'll be like,
"Oh, sorry."
It's not like that. It doesn't work like that. You got to know that when you start to face these guys, it's just their head is going to rise up.
I'm going
to
double down on that and make an argument that is actually the sign of real evil. Because, you know, we all make bad choices and we all find ourselves in situations where we might even be in abuse of power. But when we're confronted, the question of whether we do a cheshbon nefesh, a self-accounting, and back down, or whether we say, "What? No, I'm going to squash you like a bug," is really the difference between what's redeemable and what's not. So
there's a lot of that right now in the world politics.
Oh, gosh.
There's right now a lot of that where people are just like, they're pushing against the bad guys, but the bad guys are coming back, and there's this moment like, how far are you going to take this?
Yes.
And you always think that the advantage, or it has been for the last many decades, the advantage has been to the bad guys, that they'll take it further.
It won't stay that way. We have a promise.
Well, that's true. You're right. But it really takes people. It takes a Maccabee. It takes a Ben-Gurion. It takes
someone who wants to make it happen. As we saw in this project, God could do it without us. But it's not the goal.
Right. It takes a Churchill, that type of thing. Like, it takes somebody who's
I saw Dunkirk on the plane on the way home.
Was it good?
Phenomenal.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
Well, I mean, like, as a movie, it was just a little bit slow, but the story is so powerful.
Okay. I'll definitely watch that. I'll definitely watch that. In any case, just let's finish off. The evil doubles down, and basically what Farrow says is that you're going to make those bricks, but I'm taking away the stuff of the bricks, right? I'm not giving you the fodder for the bricks. Which is a weird thing, right?
Yes.
Like, make the stuff, but without the stuff. Go figure it out on your own. What kind of, that's a weird punishment. One thing is, like, I'll kill more of you. I'll, like, make the stuff, but without the stuff. You want to have a god? Here.
I think part of it has to do with the depth of slavery that we're dealing with. I mean, don't forget that to this very day, many of the things that we do, many of the commandments that we perform and the services, acts of service to God we do, are as an act of remembrance of Egypt. We're playing this out 3,500 years ago because God didn't just save us from Egypt, right? He didn't just take us out of Egypt. He redeemed us from the house of slavery. As we say on Seder night, right? We could still be stuck in Egypt, not sociopolitically, but psycho-emotionally. Mm-hmm. And this is what had so much power over the Jews. He said, now I'm not even going to give you the materials to be slaves. You must go find your own materials and be slaves on your own initiative.
Wow.
It's a deepening of what's happening.
That's
deep. And this is why, well, I guess we'll speak about it next week, that Moshe doesn't get it. He turns to God and says, Lama Hariota.
Like, why have you
made things worse?
Yes, see what I told you? Right. I was not going to do a good job. This is not the right thing. And, you know, recently, Rav Arush, Rav Shalom Arush, was in our town in Efrat, and he spoke great stuff. And he said something which moved my wife and I very much. He said, a lot of us think, God, you got to do tshuva. You've got to
make
repent.
Up for this. And you didn't make
yeah,
up
you,
that,
didn't,
yeah.
You didn't do right by me.
Right.
You got to do tshuva for what you've done to me. And in a sense, this is, you know, Moses is like, I don't get your game.
Yes.
And God says, to him, and he's going to be punished for these
Well, we'll
phrases.
Speak about it next week. Right. It's the critical opening of next week's parsha.
Right. But he is, but God says to him, now you'll see.
Yeah.
Now you're going to see Asher Eser to Pharaoh. You'll see what I'm going to do to Pharaoh. Ki biyad chazaka yishalchem. In a strong hand, he'll send them out. Ubiyad chazaka yigarshem me'atzo. And he'll send. And he'll.
He himself. Notice the same thing.
Right.
I could do it without Pharaoh, but he's going to send them out. He's going to want them to leave. It's really the theme of the parsha. You got to want it.
You got to want it. All right. That's the name of the show. Is that the name of the show? You got to want it. I'm gonna try to remember that. All right, folks. Rabbi Mike, it's great to see you again, and it's great to be elucidating and understanding better together this fabulous Torah portion. I'm excited for the Book of Shemot.
Me too.
Excited for the Mishkan this year.
Oh,
I'm excited for the pieces of the Mishkan. I'm excited for seeing it being built. I'm excited for the service of God through, and that happens in this book.
That's right.
This is going to be the first book of commandments, of stuff.
That's right.
Of law. Of that stuff which is the stuff of Judaism.
And of peoplehood.
Right. Peoplehood, but we already started on the road of peoplehood. I'm saying, but okay, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the brothers and all that. But now we're going to get stuff. And we didn't have any stuff before. We didn't have any swag. We didn't have swag to service of God. So maybe swag for the service of God. No, we'll keep that for later. What's the name of the show? What did you say?
You got to want it.
You got to want it. That's exactly right. Okay, folks, I also want to thank Rabbi Mike. Sure, I want to thank Pardes Institute here for hosting us. I also want to thank the good people at Tchelet. Have you gotten your Tchelet yet? Are you sporting the blue string? Are you a true blue Jew? Or are you a Jubu? You know what Jubus are? Jewish
yes.
Buddhists, of course. That's a term from the 60s. Jubus, what are you thinking? Now, we're going to take those deep thoughts of Jubuness and we're going to move it over to being a true blue Jew. Our good friends at J Brick making amazing Lego pieces. Now I'm working very hard with Yitzi to make a Maratha Machpelah set. Okay, is that going to be awesome?
Awesome.
Is that going to be awesome? Everybody's got to have a Maratha Machpelah set in your house. That's the Jewish peoplehood aspect of it. I want to thank the good folks at Janglo, janglo.net for providing all the amazing information for Living in the Land of Israel. I want you to go there. If you have any questions about Living in the Land of Israel, go to janglo.net, the original information highway for Aliyah, for living in this land. And I want to thank the good folks at Hebron.org. Hebron Fund is the organization that will bring you to see the mothers and the fathers in Hebron and connect you to building a Jewish Hebron. I want to thank everybody. I want to thank the Land of Israel Network, this fabulous network, which is doing so many great things. Please write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, or you can visit me on Facebook, Yishai Fleischer, on Twitter, Yishai Fleischer, and et cetera, you know, LinkedIn and all the rest. Rabbi Mike, you also have a way for people to reach you?
Yeah, here I can give Rav Mike at thelandofisrael.com, also Rav Mike on Facebook, and RavMike.com is up, so you can visit me there as well.
I'm excited to see RavMike.com. Maybe RavMike.com and YishaiFleischer.com
can cross-link.
Can take a walk together. God bless you folks wherever you are. Let's get into this new book of Exodus and let us really want it. You know, we've got to really, really want it, and we've got to also feel the love for the other and feel the pain of the other, and that way the world will be a better place. We'll have both peace and justice, and they'll link up somewhere down the line. God bless you folks wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong. Shalom, and be strong wherever you are. Kisses from the Land of Israel.